find the hope you have. Kinda let him know. For the hope that lies in you. Kinda let him know. Kinda let him know. To be ready to give an answer. Kinda let him know.
Welcome to Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, A.C. Felder, and today the topic is debunking the mythological roots of Christianity. And to discuss that with me, I have a special guest, Alan D. Donato. Did I get that right?
Perfect.
All right, let me tell you a little bit about Alan. Alan has a bachelor's in classics. What is classics?
Classics is a study of ancient Greek and Roman civilization.
Okay, good. A master in classical archaeology. He's an instructor at Central Piedmont Community College, where he's taught ancient and medieval humanities and myth in human culture. So he's aware of mythology, and he's also aware of Christianity.
Yes.
So he's a good person to talk to about the mythological roots, because I hear a lot about the mythological roots. As a matter of fact, I'm going to let you go ahead and make, what is the basic argument regards to Christianity and its mythological roots?
One of the biggest problems that Christianity faces from the skeptics with regards to myth is that they try to characterize the Bible, a lot of the biblical stories, particularly the New Testament Gospels, as myth, with the general understanding that myth is somehow not true. The idea is that they try to pull out the parallels between the Gospel, the story of Jesus and his life, and other pagan gods that have came beforehand.
Right.
And it shows up in other stories as well. I'm just using the Gospels maybe as an example. But you find the parallels also in the Old Testament, and their basic argument is that because you have these parallels, obviously the Christian scriptures have copied from these pagan sources.
Right.
So therefore it can't be historical, it can't be reliable. Right. The best you have is some kind of fiction that may serve some theological purpose, but shouldn't be trusted or definitely believed.
Right.
The basic argument is actually be structured somewhat like this, that if there are parallels, then there must have been copying. And when I say copying or borrowing, I'm basically talking the idea that the story has been at least transmitted through some kind of chain, whether it's an oral transmission, just stories that have been passed down over the years, or even up to the point where somebody actually sat down with an old text and copied it, maybe changed what they wanted to change, but were basically working off of something that came prior.
Right.
Okay, whether it's intentional or unintentional, doesn't matter, it's going to serve as copying. So, you know, that's your basic premise, is if there's parallels, then there must have been copying. And then they go to the Bible and say, well, the Bible obviously has parallels, therefore the Bible must have been copied from these other sources.
Right.
And it's a logical argument. You know, as a syllogism, it's valid. The problem is, it's not a sound argument. The problem, I think, is with the first premise, the idea that if there's parallels, there must have been copying. That's actually what they have to prove.
Right.
And they bring up all these parallels in an attempt to prove it, and I don't think they ever can sufficiently come to the degree of certainty that they're trying to arrive at. If you're going to put it in maybe a hypothetical type of framework, the idea is if there are parallels, then there's copying. I don't mean to go too much into logic. It's another one of the classes I teach at Central Piedmont. But when you're dealing with a hypothetical, if something, then something else, you've got to have the statements in the right place. And what they try to do is when they say if there's parallels, then there's copying, they're treating the idea of parallels as something that guarantees copying.
Right.
Okay, we call that a sufficient condition for what follows. The problem is, I don't think parallels is a sufficient condition. I don't think that it guarantees that there's been copying.
Right.
Logically, you've got to actually put those propositions in the other order. Okay. I think the appropriate proposition would be if there was copying, then there's going to be parallels.
Right. Okay. I see what you're saying.
Because if you copy something, it guarantees that there's going to be parallels.
Right.
Right?
Right.
If you don't have any parallels at all, then you obviously haven't been copying.
Right.
Because even if you copied something and changed a little bit here, a little bit there, you know, you're still going to have some parallels. And if it's completely different, then what have you done? You've basically gone completely away from the original source and you didn't copy it at all. So the correct proposition is if you copy, then there's parallels. So we could sort of put the Bible in there. If the biblical writers copied from pagan sources, mm-hmm. then you're going to have parallels with those pagan sources.
Right.
And I think, you know, even conservative Christians can agree that that proposition is true. Second proposition.
The argument itself.
Yeah. Well, that's the first stage in an argument.
Right, right.
The second proposition would be, well, the Bible has parallels. Okay? And I'm willing to actually say that's true too. I'll accept both of those premises.
Okay.
But what is the average person then going to conclude? If the statement is, if the Bible author is copied, then there's parallels. There are parallels, therefore.
Then the Bible was copied.
The Bible was copied. That's exactly what the skeptics and the opponents of Christianity are going to assert. The problem is that that is not a valid argument. What they've done is they've basically broken the rules of logic to derive at that. It's called the fallacy of asserting the consequent. You can sort of put in a proposition that's easier to understand. If I gave you the example that, you know, if the battery is dead, and I didn't come up with this example myself, but it's one I use in my logic class a lot to help them understand what, you know, that type of argument structure is. If I say, if the battery is dead, then the car won't start, and I say, well, the car doesn't start, can they conclude that the battery's dead? Well, of course not. It's
right,
obvious
right.
In that case. It could be all kinds of other reasons.
Right.
Maybe there's no gas in the car. Maybe
right.
There's a different problem with the engine.
No engine.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things. Right. It could be other than the battery. But that's exactly what the skeptics are saying when they're making these arguments. The argument that the Bible copies from these sources, the best they're going to do are provide parallel stories, and they're going to try to show the similarities. There's really no logical force behind that kind of argument. It's purely a rhetorical argument. It's designed to persuade somebody,
mm-hmm.
but it's not proof.
Right.
So I think the Christian's job is to show why it's a weak argument, and part of the tactic is to actually go and look at some of the parallels.
Let's look at some of the parallels.
So, using, like I said, just the stick to the Gospels for now, because as far as Christianity is concerned, that's the core of it, right? You can't have Christianity without the life of Jesus, without the death and resurrection
right.
in particular. Some of the parallels, one that I often talk about when I'm giving lectures on mythology and Christianity, I'll go back to the parallel of the god Dumuzi, ancient Sumerian god,
mm-hmm.
And his particular version of a death and resurrection. I mean, the idea that Dumuzi, who was the shepherd and king, dies and then comes back from the dead is one of the parallels that's sort of brought up over and over again. Another would be the god Osiris in the Egyptian pantheon. That's
right.
probably one of the most famous ones.
Right, right.
People bring up the god Dionysus in ancient Greece. So there's three major civilizations with a major god in each one, Dionysus in Greece, Dumuzi in Sumeria, and Osiris in Egypt. All these regions had obviously influence in biblical history. Okay, the Hebrews had contact with all the different people, the Mesopotamia and Egypt and Hellenistic world. So it's easy to see how people could say, well, there's these stories that have these parallels, therefore Bible writers just borrowed those stories.
Right.
Changed the characters.
Right.
And you can't really trust it. And a lot of scholars take that tactic. For one, I'll just give you a couple examples of some scholars that use these techniques. Joseph Campbell, who's probably one of the most famous scholars in mythology of the 20th century, I think he passed away in the late 1980s, wrote a number of different works, many of which bring up problems for Christianity, the idea of taking Christianity as a historical religion. His particular perspective is that all religions are true, and I'm sure you've heard that over and
Absolutely.
Over again. And his perspective is that religions are true if they're understood the right way. If you read they're myths, okay, and that's what he says. All these religious stories are myths. He doesn't distinguish the Christian scriptures from anything else. If you read them as metaphor, they're true. There's truth embedded in them, okay? And he just believed that these stories just don't coincide with a modern scientific understanding of the world, so you've got to either understand them a different way or toss them out. I don't think he said toss them out, but, you know, you reinterpret them the right way. And that type of thinking even pervades theology, sadly. You've got people sort of on the liberal end of the theological spectrum, figure by the name of Rudolf Bultmann is probably one of the most influential in dealing with the New Testament and mythology.
Right.
And he basically had a very similar approach to Campbell, not necessarily that all their ideas are the same, but he also agreed that a modern scientific understanding of the world doesn't jive with the New Testament view of reality. And he said, if we're going to keep reading the New Testament, you basically have to understand it in a different way, mm-hmm. or it's not going to be relevant to modern day.
Right.
And what he wanted to do is sort of strip away the mythology. He called it demythologizing the text,
right.
in order to get at what he considered was the core, the kerygma, the main teaching, the main thing that we're supposed to get out of it, sort of to sort of rescue Christianity from becoming irrelevant.
Yeah.
But for him, it wasn't just getting rid of the myth, you know, sort of cutting and pasting, but reinterpreting the myth, existentially or anthropologically, that the myths aren't telling us about what happened, they're telling us more about who we are, okay? Things like that. So, you get a lot of people taking that particular tactic. And I think one of the problems with approaching myth is when you're dealing with people that don't know a lot about myth, you're often dealing with misunderstandings about what exactly myth is.
Yeah.
And it's convincing when they hear these arguments, because they don't really know how to understand, how to weed through, you know, the rhetoric and get to what's true. So, I mean, I might ask you, I mean, what would you say myth is just from your common encounter with the word? I mean, everybody has
basically. Yeah, I would say a myth is a story that was made up a long time ago that never really happened, mm-hmm. and people just believed that it was true. After a period of time, people just started believing it was true, although it was never true, it was just made up, and started believing in it.
Okay. Yeah, then that's generally what people believe. That's what people assume. If it's myth, it's false.
Right.
And that basic view goes all the way back into the ancient world. As a matter of fact, when the word is used in the New Testament in 2 Peter 1:16, he uses the word mythos when he's talking about cleverly invented tales. And he's saying that this is not what we're preaching. We're not preaching these myths. So the word is definitely legitimately used in that sense as a fiction of some sorts. In the modern approach to myth, mythology, the study of myth, most people in the field, and there's lots of different fields that study mythology, not just people that study myth in particular, but anthropologists and archaeologists mm-hmm. and historians and so on, don't generally look at the word as meaning some fiction. Okay, a lot of times when people are talking about myth, they're talking about trying to get to the truth behind the story. So rather than emphasizing what's false, they often emphasize what's true. And this, again, would be not uncommon. People like Joseph Campbell that I just mentioned, if they interpret it the right way, it's all true.
Right.
So there's this emphasis on certain truths, I guess you could say, that are sort of embedded in these stories. And if you read it the right way, you can get at the truth. I think for...
And what is the truth according to Campbell?
Well, according to Campbell, there's all kinds of different ideas. It's not just a single truth. And he talks about, you know, bliss and coming to sort of realization and some type of individual salvation, sort of a mystical approach. He seems to be very
pantheistic. So is truth, in his estimation, is it subjective or is it objective? Is it something that is true for everyone, or is it just something that's true for the person who's believing it?
Campbell comes from a very subjective background. It's true for the individual.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which, in my estimation, doesn't mean that it's true at all. I mean,
right.
Because
that's what it boils down to.
Yeah. If it's only true for that person, then that's not true.
I mean, right.
Truth, by definition, is true for all people, all places, all times.
Right.
I mean, all truth is objective, but you know, like, we all know that not everyone holds to that very reasonable and logical statement I just made. But go ahead.
Unfortunately, it's sad that that's true, but it is.
Yeah.
So as I was saying, with the idea of myth is false, there's a couple things that I have a big problem with. First of all, it's not really the definition that people in the field are applying when they're looking at these stories. Second of all, for the Christian who has to deal with these objections, you know, the enemy is basically trying to convince us that the Bible is myth.
Right.
And if myth equates with false, and then the objection is going to be that the Bible really isn't very much different than these other stories based on content or style, therefore it should be considered myth as well, you conclude automatically, well, if it's myth, it must be false as well. Okay.
Right.
And I think that Christianity would end up having, or Christians would have basically two arguments to make for the historical reliability. First, you have to argue that the Bible is historically reliable. Second, you would have to argue that the story is not a myth at all.
Right.
And the problem, if you make the argument that the Bible is historically reliable, you would think that that would sort of settle the issue.
You would think.
Yeah. Well, if historically reliable, obviously it's not myth.
Right.
The problem is that all the arguments that we come up with for the historical reliability of Scripture are basically inductive arguments. And we can
Now explain what you mean by that.
An inductive argument is an argument that doesn't arrive at certainty. It can arrive at a high probability of it being the case when we add up all the evidence for it. And I think the Christian arguments, you know, based on all the evidence that we have, leads to a very high degree of reliability that the Bible is historically reliable. But for the skeptic, once they introduce those mythic parallels, all that does is sort of brings down the, I guess, percentage reliability. Mm-hmm. It makes it seem less certain, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what they're trying to do, undercut the historical evidence that we can come up with. The other problem with defining myth as false is that you have a criteria for determining this, you know, how you're going to classify the story based on something that's not in the story itself. I don't know if this makes sense per se, but you could pick up a story and read it, and you won't know if it's myth unless you also know how that corresponds to outside reality, right? You need to have what it corresponds to. Does it correspond to an actual historical event?
Right.
Okay. And if you don't have that information, then you can't judge the story. In other words, you could be reading a story and you think it's myth, but then all of a sudden you have all this historical evidence comes up. All of a sudden you've got to reclassify it.
Right. Okay.
Well, obviously it wasn't a myth.
Right.
It's true.
Right.
So I think you need to come up with really an objective definition that's rooted in the story itself, that you could just read the story and you could say this is myth. And the definition, I think, that is the best at sort of summing up what myth is I think myth is a story that acknowledges a supernatural and metaphysical reality as it deals with cultural concerns and universal human questions that's at least partly, if not completely, traditional in nature. I know there's a lot to that definition.
Right.
The first part, obviously, it's a story. It has to be a story. Second is that it acknowledges this supernatural metaphysical reality. It's the idea that these mythical stories deal with a world that is often beyond the senses. They're dealing with things other than what we see.
Right.
Okay, that there's spiritual realities in the background and other things like that. You've got cultural concerns, which would be concerns that are sort of specific to a particular group of people, maybe in a particular time or location. And you've got, beyond those, these universal questions that are just of concern to every human being just by virtue of being human throughout time and without regards to geography.
Right.
Okay. When I talk about it being a traditional tale, it's a tale that is either passed down, maybe there's an oral tradition behind the story, maybe there's a literary tradition, but it's still traditional in that it's a living story that still has relevance from generation to generation or has sort of influence in those ways. Now, if you use that as a definition, I think it's a good definition because it really deals with everything that's of concern for anthropologists and folklorists. Mm-hmm. It deals with religious and philosophical worldview. It has room for that. It also has room to deal with the content of the stories and the function of the stories. And those are the big issues when you study stories. The other thing that you also get when you adopt that particular definition is if you apply now the Scripture to it. Okay, do the stories in the Bible line up with that definition? Are the stories in the Bible stories that acknowledge a supernatural worldview?
Right.
They do.
Right.
Do they deal with cultural concerns and universal questions? They do.
Correct.
Are the Scriptures a traditional thing? Of course they are. You know, we meditate on them, you teach them to our children, we, you know, pass them on from generation to generation for thousands of years. They're very traditional tales. So by that definition, I would say, and this is where I'm often very controversial, is that the stories in the Scriptures are myth. But what's not included in that definition is historicity, okay? That's completely a separate issue because that definition doesn't tell me whether the story is true or false. I think there's different criteria that you should use. So my particular perspective is if you adopt the right view of myth, then you can classify the Scriptures as myth. Taking them as historically reliable, you got to use other criteria, and that would be whether or not it lines up with history.
Right.
And you use the same criteria for looking at pagan myths. Do they line up with history? So on the one hand, you've got the Bible and these pagan stories that all have certain similarities. They all fall in the category of myth, but they don't all necessarily fall in the category of historical reliable texts. And I think that's, first of all, the place that we need to start our investigation. Of how Christianity jives with these things. Hopefully, I don't know. Stop me if I've.
Well,
gone
I guess
too far beyond what I needed to there.
Let me see if I understand what you're saying. Sure. What you're saying is that although by your classification you would say that it's myth because it's a story and it's about the supernatural, it meets that criteria. And the same thing is with some of the pagan stories. But what you're saying is that. But that doesn't tell the whole story. But although they are supernatural, although they tell stories, that is a different story than whether or not they are historical.
Right.
So the pagan stories, although the Bible is stories, the gospel is stories, but they are historical, whereas the pagan ones are not historical.
Right.
So we're talking about two different things. Myth and historicity are two different things, what you're saying. So what we're saying is that the Bible has both.
Yes.
I mean, it has the stories and it has, all the other elements you were talking about, but it's also historical, whereas the pagan stories don't correspond to history.
Right.
So that makes them not true.
Right. And that's what I want to make sure I emphasize, because sometimes when I give my definition, it's not always clear that what I'm saying.
Right.
When I say that the biblical stories are myths, I'm not saying they're false.
Right.
And
right.
That needs to be clear right from the get-go.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, there's just different criteria.
Right.
Some people have defended the Bible against charges that they're myths use sort of stylistic criteria. They say, well, the biblical gospels are not of the same style of literature as some of the pagan stories.
Right.
They're biographies.
Right.
I think that's sort of tricky because, style can be fairly subjective. There's different scholars that'll come in and look at a particular text and sort of put it in one category. And bigger problem is that all these different stories come in different styles. There are pagan myths that are written in the form of biography.
Right.
So you can't classify them based on style.
Well, there are a couple of ones that I hear all the time,
mm-hmm.
and I want you to be able to respond to them.
Sure.
And I was having this dialogue with an atheist, and one of the things that he brings up is that Easter is basically comes from the pagan god Ishtar, which was the god which represented resurrection, and that basically Christianity stole that whole story about the god of Ishtar, and that's where the resurrection came from. How do you respond to that?
Okay, well, that goes back against some of the parallels that I was talking about with the Sumerian Mesopotamian region. Ishtar is a goddess of love, sometimes also associated with war, of the Near East. Babylon in that particular region. And obviously there's a similarity between the word Easter and Ishtar.
Right.
The idea that the resurrection connects to Ishtar usually goes back to the story of Ishtar and Tammuz, which is really just a later version of the story of Dumuzi, who I mentioned earlier, the Sumerian god Dumuzi, and his bride Inanna. It's basically just the same gods, different names. So Tammuz is often looked at as sort of a dying and rising god. The stories are really vague. We don't know how he comes back, if he comes back.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really confusing. Dumuzi, or the earlier version, and those are the texts that I think are more reliable as far as actually seeing that he returns. It's basically a fertility type of a story.
Right.
You're dealing with the annual cycles of vegetation, death and rebirth of the crops, and those types of things, which are fairly common in almost all the pagan myths that deal with some kind of dying and rising motif.
Right.
As far as connecting with Easter, obviously the number one is the idea of what are the Christians celebrating at Easter is the resurrection.
Right.
Inanna, rather Ishtar, is a goddess of life associated with that whole motif. The problem is the word Easter is not the word that was used early on by the Christians. There's really no indications of any connection with Ishtar worship in early Christianity at that time.
Right.
The word Easter, from what historians are able to determine, actually comes from an Anglo-Saxon goddess from, Western Europe, known as, the pronunciation I'm never that sure of, but Oestra or something like that. And we don't know a whole lot about her. She seems to be a fertility goddess. She was associated with the bunny and the rabbit as a fertility figure. Apparently one of the stories is that it was originally a bird that she changed into a rabbit, which explains why the rabbit produces these eggs, because it used to be a bird. But that particular explanation for the origin of the word Easter, you don't hear where that comes from until about early 8th century AD from the Venerable Bede, who is an Anglo-Saxon historian. Okay. And he mentions the connection, you know, with the Anglo-Saxon goddess.
But there's no real connection between the resurrection and this Ishtar god. I mean, there's no parallel.
No. I mean, the parallel they're drawing is purely on the word Easter.
Right.
And it's possible. Right. I mean, I don't know for sure. I don't know that anybody has a way to figure this out for sure. But yeah, it's possible that the Anglo-Saxon goddess derived her name somehow through contact over years. And maybe the goddess just started being changed and
yeah,
moved.
But that's an argument I hear. And another one is about Christian and the god Mithra. Now, what's the parallel there, and what's the problem?
With Christmas and Mithraism. It's similar to the issue. That's actually a little bit different. The Easter issue is primarily etymological.
Uh-huh.
Or that's at least one aspect to it. The Mithra issue is mainly hinges on the date of when Christians celebrate Christmas. They're celebrating Christmas on the 25th of December, which was the date supposedly of the birth of Mithra, or at least the festival to Mithra on the ancient Roman calendar.
And Mithra is?
Mithra, I'm sorry, I should have maybe mentioned that. Mithra, or Mithras, was sort of the Roman version of a Persian or Indo-Aryan god known as Mithra. And it became very popular really in the beginning of the 2nd century AD. It's one of the major mystery cults that competed with Christianity. Christianity, obviously, mid-first century. Mithraism sort of comes in you know, late 1st century, early 2nd century AD. And it was a cult that basically worshipped a god who ultimately comes out as sort of a deity connected with the sun. The claims are that he was a god that was sort of a dying and rising god, but there's really no evidence at all that he ever died or rose.
Right.
But then, again, the idea of Christmas being celebrated on the 25th of December just happens to be because Christians had a tradition of replacing pagan holidays.
Right.
It's not that they derived the idea of the birth of Christ from the god Mithra. It's just, you know, sort of backwards.
Yeah, actually, we're basically coming to the end of the show, but I wanted to wrap up what we've talked about. And one of the things I wanted to mention also is that I had Dr. Gary Habermas on, and he's the world, in my opinion, the world expert on the resurrection. And when I brought up these parallel stories, and one of the things he told me is that none of the parallels themselves appear before Christianity. Like the stories, like Tammuz, the story of Mithra, they may appear before Christianity, but the actual parallels to the resurrection, like a God rising and dying, or whatever those things don't appear until after Christianity. So his argument is that they stole from Christianity, not that Christianity stole from them. And I actually had this dialogue with this atheist for a while, and I challenged him to find any evidence that Christianity stole from them and they didn't steal from Christianity. And although he made a lot of assertions, he never provided any evidence at all, because my whole thing was show me something that predates Christianity that demonstrates a parallel. Show me something that predates Christianity that says that, you know, there was a God who rose from the dead and was born of a virgin and who had 12 disciples. And there was nothing. There's absolutely nothing. So I wanted to end the show with that. Basically, is that, you know, these arguments are always thrown around. They're always thrown around to make us think that Christianity stole from someone else and that it is something that's been invented by man. And that's just not the truth. There's never been any evidence of it. And you're an expert, and you basically make the case that these alleged parallels don't exist. And I want to thank you for being on the show.
You're welcome. It's great being here.
Alan DiDonato, talking with me about debunking the mythological roots of Christianity. And that will end this episode of Giving an Answer. Be sure to join me again next time. And until then, goodbye and God bless.
You can find out more about Giving an Answer, as well as listen to other episodes, by visiting us online at www.givinganswer.org. For the hope that lies in you.